The Venturi's Voice podcast brings together some of technology's brightest minds to discuss all things leadership, technology, and staffing. Keep the conversation going in the Venturi's Voice Slack group and have the opportunity to meet some of our amazing guests. You can download Venturi's Voice via iTunes or via the Venturi Group website at venturi-group.com. Today's guest is Mark Graban, consultant, professional speaker, and author. Thanks for joining me anyway, Mark. You know, really appreciate it, especially with the time difference as well. Always a little more tricky to book in that kind of sweet spot where it's not too late for me and not too early for you. So thanks very much for being available to it.
Sure, I'm glad that worked out.
It's really cool doing these sort of things. You know, you mentioned that you've done some podcasting yourself. You have your own podcast. I think it's really poignant of the times doing kind of these more long form discussions. I suppose we do half an hour, so I suppose it probably just about squeezes in as a long form. But it seems that there's certainly the demand these days for that kind of longer form substance. It's very difficult to get these kind of short snippets and to kind of provide any substance. You know, someone like yourself, you know, who's been an author, I think you can probably appreciate that more than most. But you know, they're certainly gaining in popularity, and I'm obviously biased, but I certainly appreciate the longer form. I just think, like say, you do get that kind of better substance, and I wanted to actually ask you about it straight away because I know you've done quite a few of these type of things. But do you think that, you know, in general, we're kind of looking at that becoming more and more popular, and from your perspective, is there kind of good reason behind that?
Well, that's a good question. I mean, I think I've been doing podcasts long enough that we've gone through waves of podcasts being fashionable, and then people said podcasting was dead, and now it's roared back, you know, with a vengeance. I think some of it might be, you know, the smartphones making it far easier to download and consume podcasts. But yeah, it's an interesting question about the long form discussion. Maybe it's a counterbalance to a social media world of 140 or 280 characters and short snippets of thought. A podcast discussion is quite the opposite direction, right?
Well, I think that 140 characters or whatever, even the media itself has become very clickbaity. There's this kind of demand for traffic over substance from like an analytical perspective, and they've sort of been the KPIs in the traditional media. They have to meet targets, I suppose, like any business does from a sales perspective. But I suppose, you know, from their perspective, it's just getting numbers in the door as metrics that they can maybe make sellable from an advertiser's perspective. And I think that's like you're saying with this kind of social media era, it seems as though it's made a comeback. And, you know, even reading, you're seeing, you know, well, you know, people are spending more time with the Kindles and, you know, the reading more books now. And I think there's just, for whatever reason, that thirst for knowledge is there. And maybe it's just society not appreciating that, you know, we are actually smarter than we probably give ourselves credit for.
Yeah, and, you know, it's interesting that you bring up the idea of, you know, targets and metrics, and you ask, well, you know, why do we, you know, have behavior like this in the media, you know, clickbait or whatever terms get used? I mean, I think it ties into some of the ideas I try to caution people about in my book, Measures of Success, that targets can quite often become dysfunctional, especially when the target really just provides pressure instead of a target being something for people to rally around and work together on. You know, when there's blame and pressure and threat of punishment, people will do all sorts of dysfunctional things to hit a target. So I think when we see bad behavior, it can be helpful, you know, to ask why. And there's quite often some really, you know, reasonable basis for that behavior. If you look at, you know, people doing things to, think of it, there was a large bank in the U.S. that was, you know, abusing customers by setting up unauthorized, unwanted, unnecessary bank accounts. Well, it was a perfectly rational response on the part of the employees, you know, from their CEO giving them, you know, outrageous, unreasonable goals. And I think that's something we need to look out for in any type of setting.
Yeah. So, you know, to that point, obviously you've written a whole book around the measures of success. It's something from my perspective, we tend to talk about quite a lot because, you know, at the end of the day, people are very bottom line driven and maybe more so in various sales environments. But does that get the message across? Does that enhance performance are kind of the bigger questions. And what we're putting an emphasis on is that productive to the environment and things like culture, for example. You obviously have wrote a book all around this. So where do you even start with people, and what are some of the more common mistakes, if you can call them that, that people are making when they're trying to kind of measure success and how to approach being successful, I suppose?
Sure. Well, I think one of the really common mistakes, and I'm trying to provide some alternatives in the book here, is, you know, I think managers, leaders at different levels tend to overreact to every up and down in a metric. I mean, we see this in the news. I saw something flash on television this morning of, you know, wages are down 0.2% from last year. Well, all that tells us is wages are down 0.2%. We don't know if in the previous year they were up 0.4%, or, you know, there's context missing when we look at a single data point or a comparison to the previous year, previous month, previous day. And, you know, this overreaction and you know, leads to, you know, demanding that people come up with explanations, that people come up with root causes, that people come up with countermeasures. And, you know, one of the things I've learned from, you know, some fairly simple statistical methods is that you can learn to distinguish between what you might call noise in the system, noise in a metric, and meaningful signals. And so, you know, we don't know if a 0.2% change is meaningful. It might be, it might not. And, you know, when we treat every up and down in a metric equally, I think that ends up wasting a lot of time, consuming a lot of resources that should be reserved for responding to meaningful signals in a metric. You know, how do we know if things have gotten worse and therefore we need to respond? And then there's, you know, I think another dynamic of, you know, we have a fluctuating metric that's exhibiting noise. And if that metric is not meeting a goal that's meaningful to the organization, instead of just reacting to every up and down, we need to step back and work together to try to figure out how do we improve the system so that it generates better results. And generally the answers to how do we improve a system aren't going to be found in a really reactive question of, you know, why was last month bad? So I try to propose some different approaches in the book.
Yeah, and you know, it's really interesting points because there is that lack of substance, and it's poignant to the media comparison that we were making earlier, I suppose, around this kind of clickbaity world that we're in. It's almost systemic in the workplace environment as well, that people are trying to align their work, their achievements, or, you know, if you're a leader or a manager, align your team in a way where it may sound impressive and it may suit. And I think that's all comes down to the fact that what we're pushing from the highest level perspective might not be the most appropriate measures of that team's success, and therefore we're kind of leaning away from where the real substance is to a place where we're just spending time trying to kind of appropriate the numbers that are perceived to be important and measures of success, and it kind of moves us away from a place of substance and quality, because we're spending too much time maybe even looking and considering and reporting on the wrong things. So it has this huge knock-on effect, and it all obviously comes from, you know, the leadership position.
Yeah, and it could be a matter of measuring the wrong thing. You know, in my book, I cite Eric Ries and his book, The Lean Startup, where he had, you know, this great phrase of the vanity metric. And, you know, it could be something is easy to measure, but it's not really meaningful, or, you know, it makes things look good. You know, we can, you know, a classic example of a vanity metric would be measuring the number of visitors to our website. Well, if we have, you know, if we're a software company selling software and services, the number of visitors may or may not lead to more sales and more revenue, more profit. So let's say if a company has, you know, a blog that's meant to attract customers and that company resorts to these clickbait tactics, you know, you could do a lot of things to increase traffic that don't impact the real success of the company. So I think we need to be careful about that. And I think we need to be careful about having any single metric dominate. Many organizations, I even see this in healthcare, are really dominated by financial performance measures. And of course, that's important, but we also need to look at measures around safety and quality and waiting times and staff satisfaction. You know, I think the phrase, the balanced scorecard, still has relevance here, and make sure that we're not sub-optimizing around any one metric. You know, I have a friend in Texas who's a veterinarian, and he's both worked for large organizations and he's owned his own practice. And as he's learning about lean, you know, he asked me the other day about metrics and balanced scorecard, and he literally could not think of a single measure that was not financial based for a veterinary practice. I'm like, well, how do you measure patient satisfaction? How do you measure outcomes for the animals, or, you know, how would a hospital measure outcomes for human patients? There, I think sometimes people get trapped in a habit, or, well, this is just the way our industry measures things, instead of stepping back and asking, what should we measure? And then how do we treat those measures over time?
Interesting. Your influences, obviously, you know, you mentioned Eric Ries there, you know, but obviously you kind of constructed this, you know, this machine that's, you know, providing people with great consultation, great advice, great material and substance for them to read and engage with these things. But, you know, I'm curious about you and, you know, how you were kind of inspired and how, what your kind of education path looked like to get to the point where you are now, where, you know, you're, you know, so capable of, you know, consulting for others. So, you know, what would you say, how would you say that you kind of attained the knowledge to the point that's kind of got you to where you are now?
Well, I think a lot of it started when I was an undergraduate. My degree is in industrial engineering, and industrial engineering, you know, teaches many things, including how to look at systems, how to design, manage, and improve systems. Statistics, management methods, you know, a little bit in you know, a lot of business topics, as opposed to you know, different types of engineering. So I ended up gravitating toward industrial engineering because I like looking at systems and the bigger picture. I started my college career. At one point, I was a material science engineer, which looked at the world through microscopes. And I think I realized I was more interested in larger picture systems than I was at crystal structures. But, you know, as I, you know, went through my career, there was both, you know, formal education and then happenstance where I was exposed to the work of W. Edwards Deming, who, you know, passed away 25 years ago now, but is, you know, considered one of the most influential people in the modern quality improvement movement, you know, as a quote unquote management guru, if you will. And then, you know, as I've, you know, progressed in my career, you know, I studied business and engineering in graduate school, again, with an eye toward looking at systems. You know, when I was at MIT, there's a fascinating field and courses that are taught in a methodology called system dynamics, which teaches us, you know, to look at systems. And I think there's a really important lesson there in that, you know, every time we try to change a system, there will be unintended consequences that we couldn't foresee. And, you know, we can do our best. There are methods we can use to try to anticipate what those unintended consequences would be. There might be unintended consequences to setting a target on a metric. But, you know, I think we can be more aware of that and attuned to that and look out for these unintended consequences and you know, maybe adjust instead of being stubborn, you know, and not blaming people who are responding in very natural human ways in a, you know, what might be a poorly designed system.
And then moving on to the Eric Ries stuff and the lean stuff, obviously practicing lean, something that, you know, you're quite well known for. Was that kind of a marriage of the two ideals really that kind of led to to kind of practicing lean? And was it Eric Ries, who obviously wrote the lean startup methodology and stuff? Right. Was that kind of the bit that kind of you gravitated towards, and it just kind of made a lot of sense from the prior experiences?
Well, so now, the book Practicing Lean that I authored and edited, you know, we had actually 15 other authors who contributed chapters in the book, was not really a direct offshoot of Eric's work and getting to know Eric. But I think set context, you know, I started my career in what was originally called lean production or lean manufacturing. It's focused on the factory floor and eventually, you know, kind of broadened its view to the, you know, the manufacturing enterprise. I think that's where the phrase lean enterprise comes from. And then Eric's work to apply this in a very different setting and startups of different types, you know, I think is really fascinating. If you look at the family tree of, you know, kind of their general lean concepts, and then, you know, you can look and say, well, the children of the high level lean principles include lean manufacturing, lean healthcare, lean startup. And, you know, there's some adaptation to different industries, but a lot of it is very consistent. So, you know, in the book Practicing Lean, there are authors who come from manufacturing, healthcare, startups, and software service sector, kind of all sharing their reflections on this, this idea of what it means to practice. And part of what led me to that phrase and kind of reflecting on this and writing about it, inviting others to read about it, is that people quite often use the word implementing. You know, I say we are implementing lean. And I think that's not really the right use of the word implement. You might say, well, we are implementing a new software system. At some point, I mean, even though, you know, you might be continuously tweaking and improving that system, at some point, you know, you'd say this system has been installed. It is being used. It has been implemented. Where I think that's the wrong mental model for lean. Where lean is a never-ending journey of continuous improvement and reinvention. And, you know, there's it would be incorrect, I think, if an organization says, oh, we implemented that 3 years ago, as if to imply that, well, lean was a phase and we used some lean tactics and now we're done. Where, you know, as I've worked in healthcare, people use the word practicing medicine. You know, it's like, you know, when you, if you go to the doctor, I don't think we use the word, you know, we implemented a treatment, and maybe there are some instances where treatment is just a point in time, but I don't think we would say we're implementing health. We're maybe practicing healthy behaviors in our lives. And so, the people in other industries use this term, people practice law. You know, there's the joke of, you know, if we keep practicing medicine, maybe we'll get good at it eventually. And that made me think about the idea of lean as a mindset and a methodology that we continue to practice. We hopefully get better at what we're doing, what we're teaching others, get better at how we're coaching. I think the book is a collection of those reflections to remind ourselves that after 20 or 25 years of practice, it's easy to forget the challenges that people face when something is brand new. When lean is a new concept, a lot of it might seem counterintuitive, or, you know, people may struggle with how to bring this into an organization. Those of us who are more experienced, you know, should remember our own early struggles. And that's where the book Practicing Lean is a series of reflections of people looking back, myself included, saying, yeah, gosh, here are some things that some mistakes I made 20 years ago. I wish I knew better. Maybe you can learn from those mistakes, or maybe it's a natural part of practicing that we're all going to make mistakes. And I think the key is learning from those mistakes instead of repeating them over and over again.
And I think that the consequences of, you know, not behaving in this way in today's age, and I think that it's clearly been made possible by technology as well, to be able to fail fast, I suppose, and make these adjustments. But do you think that maybe even before, as it tends to be, these sort of terms are coined, there was still an opportunity to behave in this way? Or do you think that, like, this movement has actually been born from technical capabilities that we have now?
Well, that's an interesting question. I mean, I think, failing fast is good as long as failure leads to improvement or pivoting or whatever term you might want to use. So from a software standpoint, or let's say even with early versions of my book Measures of Success, I've used a model that's called Lean Publishing that says, you should launch early. So I think I first made the book available for purchase when it was just the first three chapters. And, to not be afraid to put something out there any more than a software company, shouldn't be afraid to put out, what Eric Ries would call a minimum viable product, and then take feedback and iterate instead of working in secrecy and then launching what you think is a completed product. So whether, I can think of the website for my book as a lean startup, where I think, when it's soft goods like an ebook or software or a website, it's easy to launch and then iterate. Where I think if you look at physical products or the construction of a building, you don't want to pour concrete and put up walls and then realize, oh, this design is bad, let's iterate. That could be very expensive. So what people do in construction, I think, is really interesting. This term lean construction gets used. And before we build the building, we build prototypes. We build, with cardboard and plastic sheeting. You build mock-ups, which are similar to the way people might do wireframes of software, and get input and feedback at a point where it's inexpensive and easy to iterate before the design, more or less gets locked in as the building is built. I think Tesla is a company that's struggling with finding the balance between the software mindset of updates and iteration. I think it's brilliant that Tesla can provide over-the-air updates to core functionality of the car, that if you buy a Tesla, it could be better in a year. The same physical car could be better in a year because of software updates. I think that's kind of mind-blowing. But then I think Tesla has struggled with ongoing iteration of the physical car, creates a lot of disruption in manufacturing and in the supply chain and in the feature service of the car, where the traditional auto industry idea is to have model years, and changing a part in the middle of a model year is a relatively rare event. Where on the one hand, I admire Elon Musk for embracing this idea of continuous improvement, but I think you have to be careful that continuous improvement doesn't create more chaos than it's worth.
Well, I think he's the extreme end of continuous improvement, I suppose. But there's clearly substance to continuous improvement, and I've heard a lot of different iterations about how the importance of doing so. But it's an interesting point to raise that we're seeing technology move and things move so quickly. And actually, before we started the show, we were talking about just getting connected over the video conference call, and how we seem to have just kind of skipped a step. It's kind of a side point, but I tend to see this quite a lot now. We're kind of skipping steps to improve for the sake of improving. And that's going to sound really old school, and I probably sound very much like my parents at the moment, actually, to say it in this way. But is there kind of that line? And actually, on the contrary, from all your various, consultative practices and speaking practices, is this actually something that we're becoming more guilty of now? It's not the fact that we're not innovating and continuously pushing ourselves to improve, but actually we're just looking to do things for doing its sake. And maybe the don't fix it if it ain't broke is quite poignant at this time.
Well, I mean, I think, there's the sometimes there's the appearance of action that doesn't really lead to progress. So, in lean manufacturing mindset, we learn to identify wasted motion, that, people building, a Tesla in the factory, there are certain motions that add value. Attaching a part to a car, assuming that part is necessary, that adds value. Moving 10 feet to walk and go get a part would be considered wasted motion. That's easier to see in repetitive manufacturing work. I think it's often harder to see that wasted motion in the realm of management. So again, you know, I think to a scenario where a manager is reviewing a metric, they're standing there with their team and they say, well, performance was worse last month. You all need to go and figure out why. You need to do something about it. That may lead to a lot of wasted motion because, you know, if a metric is just fluctuating, if it's just going up and down around an average, again, we might call that noise in the system. You know, people may run around looking for explanations, researching, talking, having meetings, proposing changes. And then you come back the next month and you say, oh, the metric's gotten better. And it might not be because of anything anybody did. It's just part of that natural fluctuation. And then the manager might say, oh, good job. We can cancel the improvement initiative. And then, you know, performance gets worse the next month. That sort of wasted motion, I think, exists in most every organization. And nobody complains about having more time than they know what to do with. So I think anything we can do to reduce wasted time in the realm of management will allow us to focus on things that really need improving, and you know, we'll be more successful as a result.
Yeah, that's interesting, isn't it? No one complains about having too much time. Yeah, I think that's it. I don't think you'll ever hear that. Maybe we should though. Maybe we should. I don't know. It's it's an interesting one. Everyone's always busy, aren't they, or at least claiming to be? And I'm like, well.
Everyone brags about it, but there's a really good book I recommend. I'm going to try to find it. I believe it's just called Slack. And it's this idea that we're taught in industrial engineering school that any system that's 100% utilized is going to have really bad performance. And it's called Slack, Getting Past Burnout, Busy Work, and the Myth of Total Efficiency by Tom DeMarco. And, you know, there's a need for people to have some free time. And when we pressure people to be busy all the time, they'll either find things to do that aren't adding value or, they'll just give the appearance of being busy instead of doing things that are meaningful. So I think we have to be careful to not put that sort of pressure on people that you always have to be doing something. We need time to think. We need time to work on improvement. And sometimes, you know, a system just needs some slack capacity to avoid, you know, long waiting times for patients or long waiting times to respond to support requests if you're a software company.
We look at technologies like AI and all various other automation tools. The compelling thing about those for me, and I do find them compelling, and I also find them really exciting. Certainly not skeptical or worried about them. I know obviously there's probably areas of concern about taking jobs and workforce concerns, but I think that the beauty of something like that is that it gets people away from doing these kind of monotonous, mundane roles or tasks as part of the job. And what it does is it actually should free up time so that busy is no longer a concern. And what you're spending the time on is the brain power. And the things that I think as humans we're actually conscious and effective at doing is actually thinking things through on a conscious level. And I think if we spent more time doing that across the board, across industry, across jobs, that's where you're going to see the effectiveness come into place, because I think we're massively underutilized with that regard and our capacity to learn and execute on things and strategize. Yeah, I think the average person is, and I can't quite support this, but I'm sure someone can, is just massively underutilized. And I think, you know, my excitement about technology is certainly this, that it frees us up and gives us time to think. And that is something that we should be celebrating, not someone who's done a million small tasks in one day and it's like, well done, you hit your target. It's like, no, this person sat there and thought really deeply and came up with a proposal or a solution that, you know, can potentially be better than what we currently have. And I think attitudes, and I think this kind of brings us full circle to, you know, your book, The Measurements of Success, in my opinion, need to be shifted more towards that realm as opposed to this kind of directly quantifiable, hard-hitting busyness that we're still in culturally, I believe.
Yeah, and you know, there's a core couple lean concepts that come to mind. One is the idea that everybody can participate in improving their own work, and then there's, I think, the second idea that we shouldn't overburden people. And so these ideas often come together where, you know, in hospital settings, and this is true in many countries, this is not just an American problem, nurses, others don't have enough time to do everything they should in a given hour or in a given day. So they're overburdened, and nurses are often then put in the unfortunate position of having to pick and choose what it is they do or not do. And if they end up making the wrong choice, they end up getting blamed for it. If you know, they think, you know, patient number three is stable, so I can skip checking on them this hour because I don't have enough time, and then that patient goes downhill, then the nurse might be blamed, unfortunately. So this comes back to the idea of the design of systems. You know, I did some work in a hospital where, you know, with the nurses, we went through and sketched out what are all the different tasks you're expected to do in an hour, and it added up to about 80 minutes worth of work. Okay, so it's, you know, it's impossible to create 80 minutes in an hour. So some of the important work wasn't happening. And then, you know, unfortunately, these nurses then, of course, have no time to participate in improvement. So when people complain, we don't have time to improve, I think that in and of itself is one of the first problems that we need to address. If improving is important, how do we create time for improvement instead of just saying, well, we don't have time, we can't improve? That improvement is necessary. For example, it's, you know, that improvement would lead to a situation where nurses aren't overburdened and patients can be provided the best care.
Interesting. Yeah, it's fascinating, right? And clearly on the healthcare side, was that something, just out of curiosity, that you kind of gravitated towards out of just pure interest? Was that something, were you kind of drawn towards an area where you felt you could kind of impact the most? What was the kind of natural progression towards that?
Yeah.
Well, so going back to 2005, I was still working for, you know, a large global manufacturing company. And my wife was changing jobs, which meant we needed to move from Arizona to Texas. That meant I had to change jobs. And some of it was dumb luck, honestly. I was in the process of looking for a new job. I got a call from a recruiter at Johnson & Johnson. They were looking to hire people for a consulting group that worked with hospitals and medical laboratories and organizations like that. But, you know, I think the one thing that had piqued my interest before that was, you know, again, it's more maybe a matter of helping create luck, if that's possible. You know, I was involved. I chose to be involved in a networking group in the Phoenix area of people who did lean manufacturing work at different companies. And through that, and you know, you could call that extra effort or initiative or what have you, I had an opportunity to go visit a hospital in Scottsdale where two women who had left Motorola were doing some work there to help improve the emergency department. And that was really eye-opening because I wouldn't have imagined the need or the opportunity or the application in healthcare. You know, there are some people who get drawn to healthcare quality improvement because they were put in the position of being a patient. You know, there are stories, there are some doctors out there who got injured or got sick and then finally saw things from the patient perspective, and that inspired them to try to help fix things. For me, I think it was more a matter of that sort of chance visit piqued my interest and opened my eyes to some of the possibilities. You know, otherwise I might have discounted that call from a recruiter and I might have said, well, no, I'm not a healthcare person. I work in manufacturing, but thankfully I didn't define myself or limit myself that way. You know, I thought, you know, here's the opportunity, you know, to work in a different setting. The worst that would happen is that I probably learn something along the way and get some new experiences. And, you know, 13 years later, you know, here I am still in healthcare. But, you know, I still enjoy occasionally when I get the opportunity to work in other industries again. You know, the book Measures of Success is not intended only for a healthcare audience. There's examples there from different industries that I've worked in, and I hope it's helpful to people across the spectrum of different types of workplaces.
Well, I'm sure it is Mark. But I mean, I'm really excited that you've, you know, taken the time to be on the show. Well, we'll kind of try and shut it down here. I know we typically go half an hour, but it's already been 40 minutes. And to be honest, I could do another hour with you. It's been really cool having you on and getting some of your insights. So we'll leave it here for now. But you know, thank you so much again for taking the time. Thanks for listening to the show. I look forward to hearing everyone's thoughts on this episode over on the Venturi's Voice Slack group. See you next time.